Dr. Gail Brunel was UUCF president from 2002 to 2004. She's a professor at Cal State University in Fullerton. How do we reconcile the conflict between ordinary moral rules and political necessity to achieve a greater good? What lessons can we learn today from the struggles in France before and during World War II? Dr. Brunel will speak about when ideology conflicts with morality, the challenges of moral action in times of political strife, and she will offer insights from her new book, Murder in the Metro, based in 1930s Paris, France. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Gail Brunel.
Thank you for inviting me today. I appreciate the warm welcome back from those of you whom I remember fondly from my time here as president, my time here at the church. And I also wanted to thank Christina for the wonderful Bob Musette music, because she may not know it, but it's incredibly appropriate, because the victim of the murder in the Metro was a great lover of the Bal Musette, and the main instrument in the Bal Musette was an accordion. And the day she was killed, she spent the afternoon dancing to accordion music in a Bal Musette. So it could not have been more appropriate. It was wonderful. I have, as I thought about how to tell, to explain what I wanted to explain here about ideology and moral ambiguity, I decided, as a historian who deals in stories, the best way to go at it is with a story. But I realized, I and my co-author of this book, Annette Finley Crosswhite, my best friend from graduate school, we've done a whole series of book talks about this book, and we always start with the murder. But I realized that the story of the murder itself is not enough to get across what I want to get across today about ideology, ambiguity, decisions, telling the truth, and choosing not to tell the truth. So I have a series of stories that are nested like a Russian doll that take us from the 1930s. We'll really start in 1997 and go back to the 30s and 40s and then come back to the present. And it's a story in which I cannot avoid, if I'm going to be honest and tell the truth, to talk a little bit about myself and Annette and the moral ambiguities that we encountered in telling and not telling the truth about the story of the murder in the Metro and what was really wrapped up in it. So where we start is in 1997. My friend from graduate school and I had been in the habit since the 80s of living together when we were in France to share expenses. We are actually both specialists in what's called early modern history, which is the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, and that's what we normally would research and teach. But in 1997, independently, in two different airports on different sides of the country, we each picked up a book called Paris Dream Book, which is a eccentric guide to France. And we read it on the plane. This was, of course, before Kindle, all right, on our way to France. And in that book, there were two paragraphs about one of the greatest unsolved, what is called locked room mysteries or murders ever committed in history. The story of a woman named Letitia Thoreau, who was the first person ever assassinated on the Paris Metro from its inception in the 19th century until Pentecost Sunday in 1937, when she was killed. And it's called a locked room mystery because here are the basic details of the murder. Pentecost Sunday afternoon. The police tracked, by the way, her movements down to the second, and it's all explained in the book, and so that's how I know her movements. She dances all afternoon in a Bal Musette. I will spare you the details of the minutes and seconds here, but the bottom line is she leaves the Bal Musette late in the afternoon, telling friends she has an urgent appointment that she has to make. She walks quickly and picks up a bus. The bus driver remembers her. She gets on the bus and is brought to the Bois de Boulogne, which is a park. It's in the outskirts of Paris, where she picks up the metro called the Porte de Charenton. She goes down into the quay. There's a thunderstorm going on. There's hundreds of people on the quay who see her. She's dressed in a new outfit, and she's recently colored her hair blonde, and she's wearing very prominently a political pin. She is the only person to get on the first-class car. Because, of course, it's in the middle of the Depression in 1937. Nobody has any money. It's very unusual. The doors close. Witnesses see her solitary figure sitting by the window as the train pulls out of the station. Less than a minute later, it pulls into the Porte Dorée station, hence known as the Crime du Porte Dorée, the crime of the Porte Dorée. The doors at either end of the car open. Two sets of people get on. They see, again, only one person in the car, Laetitia Thoreau, sitting by the window. One of the guests on the car goes over and says, "Madame, may I open a window?" Instead of responding, she slumps over, falls to the floor, and there's a 9-inch knife buried in her neck. She's dead before she reaches the hospital without ever naming her murderer. Annette and I, in 97, we're shocked to discover we both read the same book, and we said to ourselves, wouldn't it be nice if we could just abandon our boring academic research projects and take some time to investigate this murder and find out what happened? And then one of us, I won't say who, said, why not? And off we went. So we did what historians normally do. We started by reading as many secondary sources, many books as we could find, and we discovered that there was never a book written about this murder, never more than a few pages in a chapter in another book, and a great void, even though it was the Amelia Earhart case or the Black Dahlia case of its time in the press. But after the war, almost nothing. So this, of course, intrigued us more, and we went to the archives. We started with the police archives because it seemed logical that there would be files. We knew, for one thing, by the little bits of information after the war that had been written about her, that there were crime scene photos. There were cartons of documents. We went in to the police archives. And I will remind you again, we were naive early modernists. We were used to dealing with people who had been dead for 300 years. So we had no idea what to expect. We asked the police for the file on Laetitia Thoreau. We were told there is no file on Laetitia Thoreau, that there had not been a file on Laetitia Thoreau since World War II. There was nothing to see. So we took some more time, and we went to the place called the Archives National, the National Archives, because we knew that in France they have a Napoleonic justice system, which meant that you have what's called a juge d'instruction, who is like having the DA, or the prosecutor, but he runs his own investigation of crimes like this. So we went in, and we started looking. We were in a room about as big as this. The walls lined with inventories. And we knew that the inventories for judicial cases were the Series B. And we started down the wall to Series B. 1931, 1932, 1933, 1936, 1937. It stops. So our next step was to go to the front desk, and it is like this. You go up to the podium, the person's looking down at you like that. And we said, where is the inventory for the documents for 1937? And a very sweet young thing, who was probably in her 20s, said, oh, it's right here, and handed us a handwritten inventory. We opened up the inventory. While we're looking at it, looking for the case in Laetitia Thoreau, which we find after a few minutes, an older man and an older woman walk over, and they pull The young archivist aside and start to remonstrate with her in French. Then they send her away red-faced. The man comes over. He takes the inventory from us. Of course, we're foolish little Anglo-Saxons. We should have been writing everything down as fast as we could, but we didn't. And he closes it, and he puts it away, and he says, "It's almost closing time. You'll have to come back tomorrow." So we come back the next day. Inventory? There's no inventory for the judicial cases of 1936. They'd never been inventoried. But we were both there. You know, thank goodness there were two of us, because otherwise we would have doubted our own sanity at this point. No, no inventory. You can't see it. Nothing exists. So then we went to the Archives de Paris because we knew that they had a lot of documents about an organization called the Cagoule. Cagoule in French means hood or hooded ones. And from the newspaper documents we had seen from 1937, there had been mention that Letizia Dereux was tied to this organization in some way. We didn't know what it was, but we knew that there were many documents. So we went to the Archives de Paris. We asked an archivist. And to cut a long story short, after some hysterics and tears, she told us there was nothing to see. And anyways, every document on the Cagoule was classified. And we could not see any of them without applying for special permission. So, again, in a room about twice the size of this, with very long tables, at least as long as these pews, Annette and I sat down alone at a table and looked at each other and said, "Do we really want to do this to ourselves?" Because it was very obvious that we were getting into something that was much deeper and murkier than we had ever before. But we had, by this point, learned a few things about Letizia Dereux. Not a lot, but enough to drive us. And it drove us and became something of a crusade. It took us from 1997 to 2002 to get our hands on the most important documents. And at the time, even then, they were all classified. Many of them still are. I'm spending, starting Thursday, about 5 weeks in France in a room the size of the ladies' room here being watched every moment while I read the classified documents on these sequels that we have planned to Murder in the Metro. Others have been declassified, but it took the deaths of a lot of prominent people in France, including François Mitterrand, before we could see anything. But we were driven because of Letizia Dereux. What we discovered about Letizia Dereux initially was that her maiden name was Nourissat, and she was actually an Italian. She emigrated from the Val d'Aosta, which is a region of France, sort of near the Alps. And her mother, when she was a teenager, left her father and brought the children to France. And Letizia Dereux and her mother ended up in Paris, where Letizia was a factory worker. And initially, after her death, the descriptions of her in the newspaper talked about a person who was a respectable widow at 27 years of age, ravishingly beautiful, kind and charming, giving gifts to little children in the streets, working at the factory where she was beloved by everyone, and a woman who loved to spend her time when she wasn't working dancing at Bal Musette or as a hat check girl in Bal Musette. So she danced for money, and she was a person that was beloved all the way around. So we were determined to dig further. We made a pilgrimage to her grave in the cemetery of Thiers. We tried to contact her family with no success. Nobody would talk. So again, to kind of cut a story short, I could talk a lot more about the research, but I will come back to that toward the end. What happened over the years was that a lot of moral ambiguity about Letizia Dereux and about the people that we eventually pinned the murder on, and about the people that we might have been able to pin the murder on, we're still not fully sure today, crept in. And it shook our understandings about right and wrong, moral ambiguity, who are the heroes and who are the bad guys, and how do you make decisions, how do we make personal decisions in times of stress or difficulty when a great deal is at stake. What we began to discover, first of all, about Letitia Thoreau, how did she acquire French citizenship and the name Thoreau? Well, she was working in a factory, and she seduced the son of the factory owner and married him in what is called a morganatic marriage, or a clandestine marriage, that his family knew nothing about until he up and died on her, evidently from natural causes. And so she got nothing out of the marriage because he never introduced her to the parents or brought her home. He kept her in what's called a garçonnette, which is an apartment that French men keep for their mistresses. Yes, they actually have a term for it. And basically, she went after that. She had to go back to work. But already, her marriage, it turned out, was a little bit different from how it originally been portrayed. Then it began to come out that she worked as a private detective for a man named Ruffignac, who had contacts with the French police. She was hired in the factory not because of her skill in gluing labels on bottles. Sorry, had to say that. But because of her skill in infiltrating unions and reporting to the police and the factory owners on their activities. Then it turned out that she was herself a police informer, and her mother had been so before her. Then it turned out that she had a string of lovers, one of whom was a very dangerous and powerful man that we will come back to shortly. And so it became increasingly clear to us that this woman was extremely ambiguous, because on the one hand, she was brave, intrepid, a feminist who earned her own living, who worked very hard night and day. She literally slept 5 hours a night, was afraid to go nowhere, took care of her family, including her ne'er-do-well younger brother, Riton, whom she paid a man named Jean Salimbeni to, I have to say this, give accordion lessons to him so he could earn his living as a street singer, because he wasn't good at anything else. Okay? Basically was the model of a loving daughter, according to her father, whom, interestingly enough, and especially interesting given that it was 1937, she visited frequently in Italy, Mussolini's Italy. And then it turned out that her best friend at the time said two very important things to us as we move forward with our story. One, that she espoused fascist rhetoric frequently and tried to recruit her friend to join a fascist organization, and two, that she told her friend that she had gone to Italy with her very, very powerful boyfriend and met Count Ciano, Mussolini's son-in-law. And why this is so important is because Thoreau was killed in May, and in June, a very important political assassination took place in France. Two brothers, Carlo and Nello Rosselli, Italian Jews, refugees from Mussolini, who had not only ran a newspaper in France that was clandestinely smuggled into Italy called Giustizia e Libertà, which was an anti-Mussolini publication, but they had organized a very important brigade of Italian refugees from Mussolini that was fighting Franco in Spain. And this is all tied together in ways that I won't have time to get into here, but I will be happy to elaborate if people want to know more. So the hero of our story, who had driven us forward in spending literally years chipping and chipping and chipping away to try to get at these documents, turned out to be herself a very ambiguous figure at best. Because you see, in the end, why was she killed? As we're going to discover, it's because she got afraid and she blabbed about the upcoming Roselli brothers' murder to the police. She was a double, possibly a triple agent, because evidently she worked for the Italians too. Yes. So who was she blabbing on? Speaking of moral ambiguity, our next set of stories here. What was the cagoule? In the 1930s, France was locked in a civil war. Many people don't realize this because we were told a story about France after the war. It was a story that the Allied powers, not just de Gaulle, but everybody of the Allies, wanted told because of the situation in the Cold War in the 40s and 50s. We were told a story that France was a country where 90% of the population were resistors, only a small percentage of the population were pro-fascist, and that, in fact, in reality, it was only a fluke, and the betrayal of the English and the good weaponry of the Germans, that the Germans won it all. And that from the moment of the German takeover, the French people rallied to fight against the Germans. Not. Okay? The reality is complicated, because we're also told another story, and one of the reasons why people in the West, like America, understandably had practically whiplash between the end of the war, ideologically, and say 1950, is the story we were told during the war is that the Soviet Union was heroic and non-aggressive, and that all of the conservatives, the fascists, and the people who supported them were evil, and that there were clear, again, good guys and bad guys with white hats and black hats. And then after the war, suddenly, with the Germans out of the way, except for the ones that were building nuclear weapons in Los Alamos, basically, the Soviet Union suddenly had black hats and were the bad guys. The reality is that all of Europe, with the possible exception of England, was locked in a civil war. It was a hot war in Spain, but the reality is that France was this close to a hot war in the years before the outbreak of World War II as well. The reality is that people like me, people like you, ordinary middle class people had to choose. And many of them felt that they had to choose which was the lesser of two evils. Fascism, authoritarian government, or communist authoritarian government. Because what it seemed to people in France was that democratic republican government, small r republican here, was bankrupt, was unable to function and unable to protect people. Imagine our recession about 10 times worse. Look at what the recession has done politically to our country, and magnify it by about 10 times, and then have Canada arming itself on your borders. Okay? That's kind of the situation. So what happens is that you have many men from the middle and upper ranks of the French bourgeoisie who look at the situation in France, including the violence. France is arming. People have weapons all over the place. street demonstrations. And then what happens in 1936 is you have a sort of legal political revolution with the election of a government called the Popular Front, headed by the first socialist prime minister, who also happened to be the first Jewish prime minister of France, Léon Blum. And this isn't a France which is only a couple generations at most away from the Dreyfus Affair, which was, of course, an enormous struggle about identity and the role of Judaism in French citizenship, among other things. So you have a lot of people from conservative backgrounds for whom this is Armageddon. And when a series of strikes breaks out all over France that not even the Popular Front government is able to take control of and master, at the very moment that France needs to rearm, because Germany is, and the strikes, which are fighting for benefits that we believe in, most of us, I think, a 40-hour week, vacations. The first legal vacations in France happened the year of Letizia Tarot's death. Okay? She's on one. And other kinds of social benefits. But these same strikes fighting for these things we believe in are shutting down the armament factories at the very moment that the French government feels that if they don't rearm, they're going to be overwhelmed by Germany. Which side do you choose? And what happens is that a number of men with conservative leanings and women, many women, join what we would consider to be today to be the Tea Party, only even further right. And then what happens is, it would be as if in this next election, the Tea Party runs a candidate that doesn't get elected, and a even further fringe of that group decide that the political process is bankrupt, the election has been stolen, and only direct action, violence, will serve. And so you have the emergence of a group called the Cagoule, self-described terrorists of the National Revolution meaning the renewal of Europe under fascism, the title also, by the way, of book 3 in our series, who begin to put together a secret army with the assistance of the French military and financed by Michelin, L'Oreal, Renault, and a variety of other French companies that you may or may not have heard of, which supply not only money for weapons, but actual weapons, and in the case of Michelin, engineers to build bombs that they then use in terrorist actions and germ warfare, which they try out in the cafeteria of a unionized French factory, but, and I'm not making this up, the French coffee is so strong that the typhoid bacilli don't make it. Really. But it's not for lack of trying. Only the French. Okay, so they have arsenals in every arrondissement or borough of Paris. The arsenal, one arsenal alone, yields enough weapons to fill a 7-ton military truck. When it explodes by accident, again the French, okay, while they're trying to disarm it, later on, 11 people are killed. That will give you an idea, all right? And once the Cagoule is uncovered, unveiled in 1938, and its members arrested, while the arrests are going on in Paris, overnight, in every large city throughout France, there are so many weapons in the arsenals, and people don't want to be arrested, that people wake up the next morning, and it would be as if you woke up the next morning, and your street was filled with grenades, machine guns, and weapons that people had thrown out of their basements before the police could get to them. They had their own torture cells, their own uniforms, their own chains, their own radios, their own hospitals. They intended to stage a coup d'etat. The French government was well aware of their activities and at first did nothing because they were hoping to use them if there was a German invasion. Only late in the year, in November of 1937, when they actually tried to stage a coup d'etat and the military at the last moment chooses not to join in, does the French interior minister, Marc Stormois, move in and dismantle them and arrest them? All right, another story. Marc Stormois and what happens in World War One. Of course, we all know, I hope, that the Germans invade in 1940. France falls. And the Cagoulards are all let out of prison. In fact, they're let out of prison before the war even starts because they are, quote unquote, needed on the front. And Marc Stormois, the interior minister, finds himself under house arrest. The Cagoulards, however, retain their bite. Book number two in our series, the one I'll be working on this summer, Vengeance, Vichy and the Assassination of Marc Stormois. The Cagoulards and Vichy, with the approval of Pétain, put together an assassination team headed by a woman, by the way, who wears only, and I'm not making this up either, negligees and men's clothing. She goes to the place where he's under house arrest in southern France and seduces him, puts a time bomb under his bed, and his head is blown off at 1 a.m. the next morning. So, cadaver photos. It's not CSI. So, essentially, the war comes, and the members of the Cagoulards have to make a decision because they believe themselves to be patriots, true patriots of France. They want to save France. That's why they were doing this. Many of them fight on the front, including the head of the assassination team, who fights the Germans before the fall of France and is given medals of bravery for driving ambulance trucks to the front. So like Letitia Thoreau, intrepid, brave, a true believer in her cause, who's willing to put a time bomb under the head, under the bed, under the pillow of a man and blow his head off. So there are three paths that one can take with the fall of France. None of them are easy. Vichy. The resistance, collaboration. About half to two-thirds of the Cagoulards go to Vichy because they believe that it's the last and best hope for an independent France. They believe that only by staging a national revolution in France under Pétain can France be strong enough to resist both the communists and the Germans. That's where Letitia Thoreau's lover ends up, and we're going to come back to him shortly. Others join the resistance, where, again, they are decorated with many medals and become very well-known as prominent resistors. Others collaborate with the Germans, the worst of the worst, and they are truly frightening people. They stage, among other things, a mini Kristallnacht in Paris with the help of the Gestapo. Many people don't know this, but there was a Kristallnacht in France known as the Night Blue or the La Nuit Bleue, where seven synagogues in Paris alone are blown up, and others in Marseille and elsewhere. They confiscate Jewish apartments. In fact, the head of a political organization that one of them creates under the Germans called the MSR, lived in an apartment owned by Jews and ironically is shot by the Gestapo in his apartment in 1943. That's book number three. They lead the Germans, one of them, the chief assassin for the Cagoule, leads the Germans on one of the most famous massacres ever held in French history called Oradour-sur-Glane, where somewhere in the area of 600 men, women, and children, all French, are killed, many of them burned to death by the Germans in reprisal for resistance activities. Many of the ones who joined Vichy halfway through the war, when Pétain becomes clearly a tool of the Germans, change course and join the resistance. One of them is Letitia Thoreau's lover. Another is François Mitterrand, which is one reason why all these documents were classified. Because you see, after the war, what happens is an amnesia. The choice is made from De Gaulle, from the top, and by the Americans as well, that France can only be saved, the West can only be saved from communism by choosing to forget. By 1955, even the war criminals of the Cagoule and others are all out of jail, and many of them have become very powerful and prominent people in French society. And I'm going to conclude here by telling the story of only one of them. There's several that I could talk about, but the one that I and Annette personally became involved with. That was a man named, well, we didn't know Gabriel Janté because he was dead, but his son. Gabriel Janté was one of the top three members of the Cagoule, from a bourgeois family, relatively wealthy, highly educated. He became the chief arms smuggler for the Cagoule. He was the man that Letizia Tarot traveled to Italy with to meet Count Ciano. He was a believer in Pétain, who had a great desire to save France and have a political career. His brother Claude Janté chose to be a collaborator with the Germans, whereas Gabriel goes to Vichy, and he stands by Pétain. But when the group called Les Durs, the hard ones under Laval, come to power with Pétain, Janté leaves the government and gradually joins the resistance, where he becomes a resistance hero, and at the end of the war, he's in a German prison camp. After the war, in 1948, he's tried for his activities in the Cagoule and sentenced to 5 years in prison and what is called indignité nationale, which means that he's stripped for 25 years of his civil rights, including the right to vote. So that after the war, his political career is destroyed, and he considers himself an fini, a ruined man, even though he actually headed a press called La Table Ronde and did have a career in writing and journalism. I know that he considered himself an fini, because in 2009, Annette and I had a meeting with his son, Pierre Janté. We were very, very nervous about this meeting because Pierre Janté runs Le Monde, which is the New York Times of France. We were shocked to get the meeting, and we expected maybe 15 minutes. We got almost 2 hours. His secretary called him every 15 minutes. You know, they set up with the secretary, give me a call, and I'll get out of here, but I'll say I have something else to do. She kept calling. He kept saying, I'm not done yet. And he told us a wealth of information that helped us to understand the decisions, the moral ambiguities, and the struggles. But in doing so, he put us in a position, speaking of moral ambiguity, that Annette and I are still in today, and we will carry with us for our lives, and it helps us to understand enormously the problems these people faced. Because you see, it's worse to secrecy. So he basically talked to us for almost 2 hours, and then we couldn't use anything except a photograph of his father in the book, and he did allow us to say in the book that it was true that Gabriel Janté was slumming, so to speak, with a working-class Italian immigrant whom he later, to his regret, was killed on the metro. So we ended our story not sure what to think of Letizia Tarot, whom we had started by admiring so much in 1937, a widow, supporting herself, helping to support her family, working two and three jobs, an immigrant who was taking elocution lessons to try to speak French properly, with ambitions to rise in society, who seduced not one but at least two men of a station in life far above her in a period of French history, deeply class-bound, who also betrayed the people she worked with at the factory and was a police informer as well as a private detective, and a man who was willing to fill France with weapons and possibly take part in other nefarious deeds, but who believed that he had taken the only path to save France and who remained loyal to Pétain for his entire career, even though it cost him his greatest dreams and ambitions in life. So we ended up with a problem of how do you choose, and part of the choosing is how do you tell the truth? What if you know things that could change how people think about things, but you can't tell the truth, or at least the whole truth? You have to make choices there as well. And Annette and I, as I kind of mentioned, since we are embarking on several more books on this topic, dealing with these people, at each step of the way, we find more moral ambiguity and more choices. And we realize more than we ever did when we were studying the 16th century that it's one thing to look back on the past and judge. It's another thing to try to understand and realize that sometimes understanding makes judging a whole lot harder. Thank you.
And we will have time for a talk back, so if anyone has any questions, and Gail will facilitate.
Okay, well, my answer to that is, first of all, the ambiguity that I'm dealing with in Murder in the Metro is in the 1930s. And we have to keep in mind, first of all, number one, in terms of Jews, it's not like the Soviet Union had a real good track record there either, so we can't assume that if you're worried about anti-Semitism, that that you were necessarily going to get a much better deal in the Soviet Union. But beyond that, the ambiguity is, first of all, the communists were very violent. And if you are somebody who, say, lives in a middle-class home in France and you run your own business, from your perspective, the communists were a terrible danger because they... We have to keep in mind here that there's a big difference between mild socialism, like the mild social welfare parties that you see existing today in Europe, which is not at all the communism that the communist street fighters in Europe in the 30s were espousing. Okay, they were literally taking their marching orders from the Soviet Union. That's not the fairy tale, that is true. Okay, to the point where when the Germans invade France, the communists in France refused to fight because the Soviet Union under Stalin tells them that the best way to overthrow bourgeois capitalism is to allow the fascists to fight it out among themselves and the communists will gather what's left. So in the 1930s, it was not necessarily as clear as we may well want to see it today. And so what happens when you're getting inside a project like this, where you're dealing with people, as I always tell my students, our goal is not, as a historian, to judge, because judgment gets in the way of understanding. And our goal is to try to understand why Letizia Thoreau would choose the path she chose. What drove her to it? Why would a man like Gabriel Janté choose the path he chose when he did? And how does he come to change his mind later on, and why? And so when you start to try to understand, it's different. And again, moral ambiguity, I and Annette made a choice of deliberate amnesia about things we know because we gave our word to a person and that was the bargain. That was the choice. So these are the kinds of things that I talk about with ambiguity. The reality is that, again, we were told fairy tales.
Okay? Petain was, first of all, a really scary guy, okay, from my perspective, having, you know, studied him. And now, because he was certainly tacitly, if not actively, supported the assassination of Marc Stormois, I've had to dig into him even more, and the more that I dig, the less pleasant he is. He had ambitions himself to be his own Mussolini. Okay? And so the idea that he was more benign, as he's often also portrayed, is actually a fairy tale that, among other people, Gabriel Jeanneté constructed in a number of books after the war, and other supporters of Pétain. He was, however, not a tool of the Germans until what happens is that the Germans forced him to accept his Prime Minister, Pierre Laval, back, who definitely was a tool of the Germans. And what happens is that gradually the people who supported a French dictatorship, so to speak, a French national revolution, like Jeanneté, are forced out, and increasingly the Germans, and of course by the middle of the war, the Germans actually roll into the Vichy zone with tanks, and that from there on, Pétain, who remembers, you know, in his late 80s at the least by this point, is simply loses all margin for maneuver. But so on the one hand, he was not a tool for the Germans. Number two, he was, however, definitely not a benign père de la patrie. And by the way, number three, he had planned what he ends up with in Vichy for a long time. This was not a man who stepped forward, ooh, surprise, the nation needs me. That also was propaganda. And in fact, it's likely that he was supporting the cagoule in the 30s, well before, and certainly marshals in the army very close to him were.